Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The truth about online gambling. More millennials are using their smartphones to have a flutter, and more people are funding their habit with credit cards. MPs tell the FT that the rules need to be tougher. We bring you the full report. Plus, BBC Moneybox presenter Paul Lewis on the quirk in the tax system that disadvantages people who read books or newspapers online. And property peer-to-peer lending. Can it ever be a good idea? David Stevenson, our adventurous investor, rocks up to give it a good going over. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast about personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you this week's news in downloadable form. Fancy having a flutter on the World Cup? Chances are you'll be doing it via a smartphone. It's estimated that over £1 billion worth of bets will be placed on World Cup games alone in the UK, and young people gambling on smartphones are making up a bigger slice of the bookies' custom. But when does some harmless fun tip into problem gambling? Joining me to discuss is Kate Bearley, FT Money reporter. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Claire.
So we often think of gambling as going to the bookies, but what does gambling look like for young people now, and is that leading to any issues?
Gambling's really moved out of the high streets and onto mobile phones and tablets, and that is really disproportionately affecting young people who are betting more frequently than ever on their phones, on their laptops, and suffering quite high rates now of problem gambling compared to the past. So mobile phone gambling saw the biggest rise of any form last year, and this is something that's become very normalised among young people, among millennials who will kind of bet on sports, you know, when they go to the football. Now, for some people, that's obviously just a habit and it's kind of, you know, manageable. But for other people, this is quickly becoming a problem. So millennials aged 25 to 34 accounted for the biggest increase in online gambling of any age group last year, according to the Gambling Commission. They're now the most likely of any age group to hold more than 5 gambling accounts, more likely to have gambled at least once in the past 4 weeks, and the most likely of any age group to gamble via mobile phone, and also seeing the highest increases in problem gambling. So it clearly is a problem.
Now, for any millennials or indeed parents of young people who are listening on the podcast, I mean, speaking as a parent myself, my stepson fits into that age group just about, and he is regularly doing what's called in-play betting. So, you know, it's only small bets of, you know, 10p, maybe 50p, but it's like, who will be the first footballer to score a goal?
Or, yeah, increasingly, you know, arcane number of things that you can bet on.
The digital revolution means that, you know, you don't just have to bet before the game on the end score of the match. There are all kinds of things, and the odds change. So it's really becoming part of watching sport now, I think, for a lot of young people. It kind of gives it more of an edge and makes it more interesting. But then the MPs that you spoke to in the article don't think that the regulations in this country have kept up with the speed of innovation that the online bookmakers have come up with.
No, exactly. All the focus recently has been on cuts to the maximum stakes on fixed odds betting terminals.
The so-called one-arm bandits,
exactly,
in the high street shops.
So those have been cut from £100 to £2, but people argue that you could just as easily, you know, more easily, just go online and spend however much you wanted on an online casino game, because there just aren't the same limits. Also, you can pay by credit card online to gamble, which you can't offline. So there's a real sense here that the rules are not kind of fit for the digital age.
And What do people say should be done about this?
Well, there is a group of MPs and Lords, some of whom I spoke to for this article, who say that we need a kind of overhaul of the rules, really. We need to look at things like banning the use of credit cards to gamble online. We need to look at limiting the stakes for online bets. And a lot of people, for example, Deputy Labour leader Tom Watson, particularly thinks we need to look at advertising. I mean, at the moment, you can, or gambling companies can advertise in live sports matches, even though the normal rules state that you can't advertise pre-watershed. So that means that, you know, live sports matches are kind of full of gambling ads, and people say that's something that we really need to look at.
But you also spoke to the online bookmakers themselves for the purposes of the article, and interestingly, they say that because of the way digital gambling works, it makes it easier for them to spot people who are potentially problem gamblers.
Yeah, exactly. The industry says that the real focus here should be on using data in a clever way, you know, spotting problem gambling, using the kind of analytics that they gather on their customers, and using that to contact those people, to try and help those people. And in fact, you know, the industry is doing something here. For example, they are working on a multi-company exclusion policy where you can self-exclude, you can ban yourself from one site, and in doing so, you know, ban yourself from all of them. So there is some progress being made there.
Well, obviously more progress needs to be made. Well, thanks very much there to Kate Bearley. You can read her full report online now, The Truth About Millennials and Gambling, at ft.com/money. That's free to read online, and it does contain details of any help that you may need if gambling is becoming a problem for you. How should we tax the digital economy? The amount of tax being paid by the big tech firms has come under scrutiny, particularly as their more analogue competitors complain that levies such as business rates fall disproportionately lightly on those digital business models. But what about the taxes that consumers pay on some digital services? This is what Paul Lewis has been investigating for his column in FT Money this week, and he joins me now on the line. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, Claire.
Well, essentially, you've got some bad news for people who like reading books on a Kindle or e-reading device.
Yes, indeed. It's a strange thing, but if you buy a book in a bookshop, then you pay no tax on it at all. It's exempt from VAT. But if you buy a book to read on your Kindle or another e-reader, or indeed a digital subscription for a well-known newspaper like the FT or a magazine, you will be paying VAT on that. Whereas if you buy the paper copy, there is no VAT. So it's obviously going to put the price up of these things by 20%. And I think that contributes to the fact that if you do buy a book to read on an e-reader, it's often not that much cheaper than buying the hefty paper volume that's been printed out and carted all over the country.
Well, indeed. And if you're like me and you buy books second-hand, then it's often way cheaper. But you dub this phenomenon and the return of taxes on knowledge. So how widespread is it?
Yes, well, it is a return of taxes on knowledge. These were finally scrapped as long ago as 1855. I mean, even I don't remember that. but it was a campaign. They were called taxes on knowledge. It was a tax on newspapers. There'd previously been taxes on paper. And the idea was that you took all those taxes off so that people could inform themselves and educate themselves and learn. And that's been the case right up until the advent of electronic versions of publications. So it applies to subscriptions to periodicals and newspapers. As I said, it applies to e-books. Anything that you buy online is treated as an electronic transfer rather than a piece of print, and you are taxed at the standard rate of 20%. Now, it's a bit hard to work out how much it would cost to scrap it. Mm. We know that the exemption for paper books and newspapers and so on costs the Treasury about £1.6 billion a year. And we know that roughly £1 in £7 spent on a book is spent digitally. Mm. And you can do a bit of, I mean, I call it a bit of a back of an envelope or, you know, rough spreadsheet calculation. I reckon it would cost 300 odd million for the Treasury to say, OK, however you buy your knowledge, whether it's on paper or electronically, it will be free of VAT. So round about 300 million, that kind of thing.
which doesn't sound like a lot in the grand scheme of things. But of course, the Chancellor is in a bit of a tight spot at the moment, as he admitted in his Mansion House speech last week. So do you think he would really consider trying to correct this digital anomaly?
Well, my suggestion is he does it as a kind of sweetener, because yes, he's going to have to raise taxes, and he could do that very straightforwardly by putting a penny on income tax, for example, which would raise him $5 billion a year, and he would have to do that four times to raise his £20 billion a year for the NHS.
Indeed.
But he could do that if he chose to. And whatever he does, we will notice it, because £20 billion is a not inconsiderable amount of money, even for the Chancellor. So my suggestion is, whatever he does to raise the money to fulfil the Prime Minister's promise, he should say, yes, but at the same time, I have exempt, again, all electronic material rather than printed material from tax, as historically it has been for well over 150 years.
Well, thanks very much to Paul Lewis. We will await to see how the Treasury responds to your column, but you can read Paul's column in the money section of the FT Weekend newspaper this Saturday or on ft.com right now. And don't forget to tune into Moneybox from 12 noon on BBC Radio 4 this coming Saturday. You've undoubtedly heard of peer-to-peer lending, but how about in a property context? Teaming up with other investors to buy a large and illiquid asset like a property could enable those with smaller amounts of capital to get in on the action. But is it ever a good idea? Joining me on the line is David Stevenson, our adventurous investor columnist who has been investigating this growing field. Welcome, David.
Hello, Claire.
So firstly, explain to me, how does peer-to-peer lending work in a property context?
Well, traditionally, the idea of peer-to-peer is that I, an investor, have some money that I would like to lend to somebody else who's a borrower, the peer-to-peer element. In the case of peer-to-peer property lending, that's the same model. You effectively, I, an investor, want to lend some money to someone else who is probably a, for instance, property developer or buy-to-let landlord, and they're developing a property, but they are wanting to borrow money on their property. So effectively, it's just a loan like any other loan. It's just a loan that's asset-backed. So it's secured against some property. And that property might be a buy-to-let actual property, or it might be something that's being developed. It might even be a piece of land that's going to be developed. But in reality, it's a loan to a property developer, buy-to-let landlord. Could even be a small family builder. They tend to get into this market as well. So that's traditionally how peer-to-peer lending works.
And what kind of returns are on offer?
Yeah, it varies greatly. So you can get anything from kind of 3-3.5% at the lowest range for what we call peer-to-peer buy-to-let mortgages, where you're actually effectively the person who's borrowing is another buy-to-let landlord who has actually a mortgage with you, and you get all the way up to 8-9% in some cases, and more likely to be around 5-7% in terms of lending returns. The 5-7 is four. I'd actually say more narrowly 4.5-6.5 is the kind of sweet spot for this market.
And then, obviously, the big question is, how risky is it?
I mean, on one level, it could be argued to be less risky than, say, peer-to-peer consumer lending. So peer-to-peer consumer lending outfits like RateSetter and Zopa, they're not secured. So they tend to be unsecured lending, so consumer lending, whereas at least these are secured against an asset, so usually a property, usually a house or a building. So on one level, they're actually less risky because they're secured, they're asset-backed. On another level, though, they're slightly more risky, I suppose. I mean, consumer lending goes through cycles as well, but the property market is very much going for a cycle. And we've already seen the first signs of that cycle sort of turning downwards. You know, the papers, including the FT, have been full of articles in the last couple of weeks about the declining number of transactions, the declining level of house prices. And if you talk to most commercial real estate people, which is a separate market from residential, they would tend to think that you're probably near the top of the property cycle at the moment. They can't really push rents up much more and prices are pretty high. So, you know, however you look at it, it's difficult to argue that we're not at a downward inflection or at the top of with a downward inflection coming of a property cycle.
And you say in the column different ways that people could get into this market if they wanted to. Clearly it is one for the adventurous investors only. But if people are tempted, what kind of questions should they ask before they commit?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of investors go for the classic kind of yield illusion. So what they see the top line number and they go, oh, I like the look of that. So, you know, if I've got lenders who will lend to you at, say, 6-7%, people go, oh, that sounds interesting.
Mm.
The problem, of course, though, is that that's only as good as the quality of the borrowers. So therefore, and the quality of the platform. And those are the two sets of questions you sort of need to ask, which is, who are you lending to? Where are they investing your money? So by that, I mean, are they buy-to-let landlords, which I tend to have a little bit more suspicion about, or small family builders, which I'm slightly more enthusiastic about. So regions matter. London, Greater London area, is clearly suffering in the residential market more issues than other regions. So the regions are doing quite well. So to whom? Where? And the platform also matters, because a lot of people just think, oh, well, it's well secured. It's got a low LTV. You hear this number, this acronym a lot, LTV, loan to value ratio. And what that means is £100 property, I lend you £60. The LTV is 60%. And by and large, LTVs don't tend to be much above 70%. So that sounds reassuring on paper. But the problem you have to ask about the platform is you're working on a platform. You're putting your money to work on the platform. And if something goes wrong, it's the platform that has to get your money back, fundamentally, or it's the platform that has to do the due diligence. So you've always got to work out what happens if it goes wrong. So what happens if the platform, for instance, has to take possession of the property? Are they going to hang around and redevelop it and do what they call a workout? Or are they going to do what the banks did in the last recession when property went into a dive, which is they just all basically sold them all instantly, pushed down the price, and then and if you were an investor at that point, you'd have got hit.
Well, clearly lots to think about. Thanks very much there to David Stevenson, the FT's adventurous investor columnist. You can read his column online now. Is peer-to-peer property lending ever a good idea? Go to ft.com/money. That's it from the Money Show this week. To get in touch with our team of experts, email us money@ft.com or tweet us @ftmoney. We'll be back next week at the usual time. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.